From the Sky News Centre at 5, emergency teams searching for a woman who was trapped after her home partially collapsed have found a body. Heavy rain triggered a landslide at the property in Lewe in southeast Cornwall. Dave King is from the Devon and Cornwall Fire and Rescue Service.
The property is still very unstable, and the urban search and rescue team from Devon and Somerset Fire and Rescue Service is on scene, still trying to make it stable as possible. And slowly but surely they'll get to a position where they can recover the body fully.
Snow has been causing problems across the UK. In Northern Ireland, nearly 50,000 homes and businesses are still without power. Their World Cup qualifier against Russia in Belfast has been postponed until tomorrow. Hungarian horse meat, falsely labelled as diced beef, has been found in Lancashire. Some of it was sold to the public at a market stall in Preston and at a shop in Liverpool called Taste of Hungary. The funeral of a teenager who was stabbed to death on her way to school has taken place in Birmingham. 16-year-old Christina Edkins died earlier this month. Britain's gas supplies are under pressure as a result of the cold snap, but the government insists that they won't run out. It admits that storage levels are low, but says our gas needs are continuing to be met. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
BCFM. On BCFM 93.2.
Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's Active Fed Fueled Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. Sorry, advertising, I shouldn't really do that, but I've got a bit of a cold this week. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Hotfoot from the Avon and Somerset Fire Authority, is Lib Dem Councillor for Eastfield, Steve Comer. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the Cypriot bailout. Will Angela Merkel's brinkmanship pay off? We talked to a leading finance blogger from the City of London, Ian Fraser, plus Bob Ashford, who stood for Avon and Somerset Police and Crime Commissioner last November, but was told he couldn't because he'd been a naughty boy when he was a teenager. Also, Syrian president-in-waiting is elected in Istanbul. Rumours of chemical weapons also being used in Syria itself, but by which side, as NATO makes tentative plans to invade Syria? Plus, Martin Summers takes his weekly tour of the world's other hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 Celsius, heavy showers. This weekend, highs even lower, 2. A generally cloudy weekend with some showers on Saturday. Next week, highs of 6 Celsius, warming up as the week progresses. Some possible light showers at the beginning of the week, fairly sunny the rest of the week. Next weekend, that's the 30th and 31st of March, and the 1st of April is Easter weekend. Highs of 3 Celsius, fairly cloudy with some sunshine and some possible light snow at Easter. Crikey. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is former leader of the Lib Dems, a councillor for Eastfield, Steve Comer. Hi, Steve. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, I said Hotfoot from the Fire Authority. What is the Fire Authority?
The Fire Authority is the body of elected members that actually deals with the governance of the Fire and Rescue Service within the former County of Avon. So it's made up of councillors from all of the four unitary authorities within the former Avon area, the Cuba area, as we sometimes call it.
Okay. Now, who's on that committee? How many people?
Oh, you've asked me now.
How are people appointed? How are
it's
you
about a dozen. I mean, essentially, people are appointed by the four unitary councils. So there's a number based on population.
Is it all councillors?
It is all councillors, obviously. Others that sit on it are officers and so on, but if it comes to any votes, and there tend not to be that many votes, but they're obviously the elected members that vote.
Okay. What's the political makeup then of Avon, the old Avon? You know, because it's quite interesting. By looking at the Fire Authority, you can get an idea of what would have been going on if Avon had carried on as an authority.
Yeah, and I think it's been fairly clear, actually. Yes, you're absolutely right. There's no one party in overall control. I think the Conservatives are the largest group, just followed by Liberal Democrats, followed by Labour, and there's one independent from North Somerset. So, I think that, and it's been no one dominant force ever since I've been on it, which is I think 2008. So,
and how does that work as an authority? Because there's no one political party you control. Do you find that some decisions will go Lib Dem Labour against the Tories, and other decisions Lib Dem and Tories against Labour, that kind of thing?
Usually, I think it's a fairly consensual body. The one fight we did have, which went very much to a party line split, was last year when the decision was taken on the precept, which is that element of the council tax that funds the fire authority. And in those occasions, we had Lib Dem, Labour and the Independent voting for a small increase and the Conservatives voting for a freeze. This year, all the groups voted for a small increase. So yeah, you can get a divide on party lines, but it tends not to happen that often.
I suppose the obvious question is, how are the cuts affecting our fire service? I mean, you know, we obviously, it's one of those things that you hope to God you never have to use, but when you do, you want it to be there, you don't want it to be cut.
And I think we've had a very clear policy of no cuts to frontline services and maintaining the response time, maintaining the services.
Steve, that's what they always say, no cuts to frontline services.
Yeah.
Is that really the case with the Fire Brigade?
That is the case at the moment. Whether that can continue to be the case in years to come, I think depends on future finance settlements, and that's a lot more difficult. But it has been done at the expense of, there have been cuts in back office staff, and certainly in terms of information reporting and things like that, then I think we have noticed an impact. One of the things that did help is when the coalition government came in, they took a lot of the reporting requirements off fire authorities. So in other words, we don't have to provide as much statistical information to government as we did, so that's helped. But yes, it is tough, and we know that future financial outlook is difficult, to say the least.
So I suppose the bottom line really is fire engines, firefighters and fire stations. I mean, are any of those being cut at all? Are you still recruiting firefighters, for example?
No, we're not recruiting full-time firefighters. We have been recruiting retained firefighters, because obviously with the service like that, then an element, particularly in the more rural parts, is actually a largely retained service.
So, well, how does a retained firefighting thing work then?
Well, people are employed on a retainer, which is a small salary payment, and then if they get caught out, then they come out from the day job or whatever they're doing, and come in and attend as and when necessary.
So these people who've been trained in firefighting of some sort? Okay, how does that work?
And rescue service, because obviously in recent times there's been a lot of fire and rescue staff involved in things like flood relief, rivers and so on.
I mean, in a small village, town or whatever, you might get no calls over for weeks, possibly. And how does that actually work? So someone's in that maybe working as a car mechanic or something,
yeah,
and suddenly they get a call on the mobile phone. Or
that's right.
The pager in the old days, wasn't it? And off they go.
That's right.
It's going to take a while, isn't it, to get that fire engine moving?
Yeah, but obviously they're part of a response team along with others. But I mean, you know, it's a well-established part of the service across the UK in rural areas, and it seems to work pretty well. But in most places like Bristol, then it's mainly the fire service is actually a full-time service.
So firefighters, we are actually losing. If you're not recruiting anymore, people are retiring naturally. You are actually losing firefighters, aren't you?
There have been some posts lost through attrition, but there has been some recruitment, often into the full-time ranks from the ranks of the retained. So that's happened occasionally. But yes, there have been some losses by attrition. But up until now, we've managing to maintain the service. We've not compromised on equipment. We're still replacing equipment, and our aim is to continue to do that.
Okay. Any closures of any fire stations at all on the horizon or happened?
No, none have happened. Whether there's any on the horizon, not at the moment, I would say. Although, you never know what's ahead in terms of possible rationalisation of building land and so on. I mean, it's no secret that where Temple Back is in the centre of Bristol, there's development on Finsel's Reach one side. There's another building which has been vacated. It is a site that may well be redeveloped, and we may well be looking to relocate somewhere else within the central area in the near future. But central is an important area. With others, again, I think there may be a need to look at locations in the light of where houses are being built and other industrial developments are being put up. You know, are they within the response time? But certainly there's no plans at the moment. And today I think we've taken a very important decision, is that one possible avenue that was being looked at was whether Avon Fire could gain any economies of scale by merging with its neighbour, Devon and Somerset. And today the fire authorities had a brief look at that and considered the implications for a combination and decided that that's not where we want to go.
Yeah, why is that then?
I think it's a number of reasons, really. Largely the cost of Devon Fire Service on the council tax, I think, is around £75, is around £64 for Avon. So eventually you would have to equalise that, but the money for that would be going one way. So it would cost Avon council taxpayers more over the period of time, but we wouldn't see the benefit of the money because most of it would be Devon and Somerset has an older fleet, and it's also a very different service because it's a much more rural area, and so they're much more of a retained service than Avon is. So I think it was felt that it didn't fit, and yes, you would get some savings in management efficiencies and so on, but I think we felt we ought to be, if we're under pressure, we ought to perhaps be looking at other collaborations.
Back to you, Steve. Are you up for re-election in May?
Yes,
I am up in May. That's going to be a bit of a battle in Eastville, isn't it?
You've got me just inside of the Purdah period. Yes, it is. It's going to be a close fight.
Because it's really a battle, really, between Labour and yourselves.
Yes.
I mean, what do you think, you know, at the moment, you've not got a lot of help nationally from the Liberal Democrats, and possibly not even necessarily locally. I mean, the Lib Dems were running the council. Now it's being run by a mayor who's an independent. You know, how would you convince voters to vote for you rather than the Labour Party in that ward?
Well, we're still the largest party on the council, and so although we've now got an elected mayor, that was a choice that the referendum made. And no, I think the main issue for me is it has changed the dynamic, really, because in the past you were partly asking about political control of the council, partly asking about who would be the best champion for the area, and I think now increasingly the role of councillor is much more the local champion role. I've been there 8 years. I've done a lot of work in the area. I've taken up a lot of issues, and done run a lot of campaigns. And I think it's a question of saying, well, look, you know, here's my track record of getting improvements for the area and working for others, as against the Labour Party, whose approach to it is much more of a traditional lobby fodder model.
So, I mean, as casework for individuals in your ward that you're looking after, what are the big issues? What are the big things that people are coming with at the moment?
There's a number of things. There's housing issues. There's problems over fly tipping, graffiti, pavement, streetlights,
a lot of
the basic stuff.
What's one of the problems with housing? Is it just people simply can't find somewhere to live, or what?
It's often people finding difficulty in getting housing, rented housing in particular, and particularly with people with families in overcrowded conditions. Finding the move on in housing is a big problem, and because there just isn't the housing in the rented sector, particularly in the low rent sector and social housing available in Northeast Bristol. So if people want to stay in the area, this is one of the problems that becomes more difficult. I think we've got an imbalance across Bristol in where houses are provided, and that's causing problems.
So we didn't have actual local elections last year, did we? It was our year off.
No, we had the mayoral referendum
we
instead.
Only had the mayoral elections, yeah. Which the Lib Dems didn't do very well. John Rogers, the candidate, didn't do all that well there. I mean, this is going to be the first big test for the Lib Dems in the city, isn't it, in May, since the election?
Well, no, we had local elections in 2011, so this is our first big test from them, and I think what we need to be showing is, are we doing better in 2013 than we were in 2011? I think that's the comparison, because both of them are since the general election. And if I'm going to survive, we need to be doing better than we were in 2011. The mayoral election's a difficult one to call, because it's complicated by the fact that, you know, you had a plethora of independent candidates. Actually, you had loads of them, and you had one in particular who polled very well, who was a recent ex-member of ours. So that clouded the normal political discourse, I would say.
Well, I mean, it was a kind of rejection of party politics, which you're an adherent of.
Yes, I think it was. I think you have to go beyond that and say, well, you know, why are people rejecting party politics? And I think you see that to an extent with the protest votes for UKIP in parliamentary by-elections recently. And I think it is a question of, there is disillusionment. I also think that perhaps part of the problem is political parties ourselves. I think we've all been guilty in the past, perhaps, of over-promising and underachieving. And I think maybe there's a bit of a reaction against that. I think sometimes you've actually got to confront people with the reality rather than tell them what you think they want to hear.
Okay. Now, Steve, it's more of a personal question. You were the leader of the Lib Dems, weren't you, when the Lib Dems were in opposition?
I've been leader of the Liberals and the Lib Dems on the council twice, both for a year.
Yeah, but I mean, what I can't understand is, why is it that as soon as you, through your leadership partly, achieve quite a strong status for the party in the city and they get elected, you then get swapped out sideways? Why is that?
Well, I think there were issues within the group at the time. I mean, I challenged the incumbent leader, won a narrow victory, and then lost to that leader the following year. And I think there were difficulties at the time, and I think there was a question of direction. But I mean, that was back 2007-2008. It was to my regret that I never actually led the group into the elections in 2009, which is what I intended to do. I think at the time there was a change of administration. The Conservatives decided to put Labour in 2008, and I think there were some within my group who blamed me for that, whereas, of course, you know, I had no influence over the Conservative group, and never would have.
Okay, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Martin, we're going to kick off this week by looking at the budget. Obviously, you were discussing this a little bit last week, and I suppose you were proved 100% right, really, weren't you? You said George Osborne was just going to kind of carry on the way he had done. So let's just listen now to the beginning of George Osborne's budget speech on Wednesday.
Today I'm going to level with people about the difficult economic circumstances we still face and the hard decisions required to deal with them. It is taking longer than anyone hoped, but we must hold to the right track. And by setting free the aspirations of this nation, we will get there.
Yeah, longer than anyone hoped, but not as many predicted. I mean, where we are now, I said to Nick Clegg when he just elected, and I interviewed him for this programme, said the problem with your policy is that in a couple of years' time, you're going to lose the credit rating of the country, which is your policy is based on. In actual fact, it doesn't matter that much if you lose the credit rating of the country, but we've said we had to have a whole swinging series of cuts and austerity measures in order to keep our credit rating. And of course, what's happened? We've lost our credit rating, absolutely predictably. So it's not a question of hope, it's a question of analysis. And I'm afraid George Osborne hasn't got it.
Well, also, we had the growth forecast by the Office of Budget Responsibility was announced at the budget is down a half since what the forecast was in December. It was 1.2% growth, which is not exactly amazing. And George Osborne announced on Wednesday in the budget speech that actually that forecast was down to 0.6. What does that actually mean, Martin?
Well, it doesn't mean a lot, does it? Because it just shows you the forecasts are guesses. If you can be that far out between December and now, it suggests that you don't really know what you're doing. And of course, nobody does, because things that are happening in Cyprus could bring the whole thing down and all these forecasts will be out of the window.
And
they?
Even George Osborne choked on the announcement. Let's have a listen to him now.
This year, their output forecast is reduced to 0.6% growth.
Mr. Deputy.
Yes, well, that was George Osborne trying to say Mr. Deputy Speaker and failing. But, I mean, you know, left him with a very dry throat, Martin. Steve, though, you know, this is a coalition your party is in with the Conservatives. Things are looking not only bad. They're actually worse than bad, because we were thinking 1.2% growth is really hopeless. It's now, the estimates are going down and down all the time. It doesn't look as if you're actually achieving very much at all with their economic policy. And you are in bed with the Conservatives. You can't just hold your hands up and say it's nothing to do with us.
Well, a two parties working coalition, I think it's a fairly new concept at national level in the UK. And I think it is something we're probably going to have to get used to in the future, that you know, you can be in coalition with people who have different policies to you, and you know, you have to say, well, where is your input into it? Now, the growth isn't brilliant. At least it's not a negative. At least it's on the positive side. It's half a forecast. I think probably we're in a situation where economic forecasting is perhaps less of a science than it ever was, and is getting more and more difficult. But I think there are some there are some positives coming out of this budget. I mean, we've managed to get the income tax threshold up to £10,000, and I think, you know, that makes a huge difference for a lot of low paid people, and you know, it's a major incentive for people to seek work or stay in work or stick with part time work. I think that's something that we wanted to achieve by 2015, and that's going to be achieved a year early, so that's a positive. I think a lot of the capital investment that we're seeing, some of the infrastructure investment, some of what's going on with the housing market and so on, is all very positive stuff. I don't think it goes far enough. I'm probably with Vince Cable on that. I think perhaps we should have taken a chance and borrowed a bit, but you know, we are in a coalition.
Steve, the housing market is depressed. I mean, the government took the money that it was supposed to be spending and subsidising social housing and spent it on another aircraft carrier. The people who are usually, I mean, it's very, very rarely local authorities, but mostly housing associations now, that are building houses, can't build them because the money's been pinched for the Ministry of Defence.
Well, partly that, and partly in the private sector, you've got the problem with the lack of borrowing. So I think this is also a difficulty. You know, the squeeze on finance is a real problem, and I think that's what that's trying to address by getting some building moving. And you know, that's got to be useful both from a housing point of view and the fact that it will provide construction jobs during the process. So I think that's good news. We've seen other good news. We've seen the aerospace investment earlier this week. We've got composite materials in Bristol. I think there is you know, there are some good news aspects of there. And you know, one major campaign that I've been involved in as a member of the campaign for Real Ale, you know, we've got rid of the iniquitous beer duty escalator, and that's not something that's happened overnight. That's been a big campaign by an awful lot of people. So you know, I think there are some positives in the budget.
A penny off a pint is peanuts, isn't it, really?
Well, a penny off a pint really isn't the issue. That was a surprise. I didn't expect that one. But the problem has been the escalator, where beer duty has gone up year on year by a set figure over the rate of inflation. Which has meant the price of a pint in a pub has got more expensive. The price of a can of beer in a supermarket's got, in relative terms, cheaper. So what we've seen is the closure of a lot of pubs, and that's, you know, that can sound just a bit flippant, but you know, a lot of community pubs in my part of the world, in East Bristol, you know, there's centres of a lot of social activity, a lot of charity fundraising, a lot of support for older people and so on, games and other functions all run around them, and of course, you know, they do employ people.
Well, that's also the tobacco ban, which didn't help with that, you know, whatever it was about 5-6 years ago.
I think a lot of places have adapted to that now. You know, you see a lot of outside space being used that probably wasn't being used before. So I think that's that probably hasn't helped. I don't think that's the major reason. I think the major pressure on pubs has been the fact that you know, it's the 20 cans of Stella for a tenner down the supermarket.
Isn't it also the ease of planning permission that people like Tesco's now have? They can go to the owner of the pub, can't they, and say, well, how much are you making from your building? Because we're prepared to give you this, and we'll turn it into a Tesco Express.
Yes, use class order is a big problem, in that if you want to change a pub into flats, you've got to apply for planning permission for change of use. If you're changing from a pub to a Tesco Express or Sainsbury's equivalent, then you don't have to apply for planning permission because it's both classed as retailing. And I actually think there is a case, and Greg McDonald Lib Dem MP in Leeds is pushing this as well, that what you should have is a separate planning category for pubs. So if you want to change the use, then you've got to go to the local authority and get planning permission.
Some of the main announcements in the budget, a significant £2,000 employment allowance for small businesses towards their employer's national insurance contributions bill, means they don't have to pay £2,000, which is rather nice for employers. I'm not sure how that money then will actually be paid into national insurance. UK departments, including health, schools and overseas aids, were expected to deliver a £11.5 billion saving in the next comprehensive spending review. So that's health, schools and overseas aid all ring-fenced. Plus national insurance rebate, which people get on final salary pension schemes as previously been entitled to, will go. Martin?
Yeah, and I think also that what they've been doing is fiddling the figures to make sure that the deficit is seen to be going down year on year. And there's an awful lot of creative accounting going on.
Could you just because, I mean, the thing is, the debt, we've heard, actual national debt, is going to probably, by the next election, be double what it was at the last election.
Yeah.
How does that compare to the... I mean, saying the deficit's going down, it's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? If the debt is going up and up and up to about, what is it? I think it's heading for 1.6 trillion at the moment. Mm-hmm. How can the deficit be going down?
Because the deficit is just a year on year, what you take in and what you spend, and the debt just mounts up. I mean, we've been running a national debt since the Napoleonic Wars, so that just carries on.
So in a way, is it a sort of change in the amount of money we're borrowing year on year?
Yes, kind of? I mean, and obviously from the political point of view, the government wants to be seen to having the deficit coming down, which is why they're doing all sorts of creative things like pushing money from one section of the government expenditure to another to make sure that they can politically manipulate the figures. I think the real problem is not just that the economy's stagnant, although it is smaller than it was when the coalition took over. That's very strange, you know. You've had years and years, and the economy in Britain is smaller than it was when the coalition took over. That's not true in the US. That's certainly not true in Germany. But the point is that we're facing down the barrel of a gun here, because we could have a major financial catastrophe in which Britain will be at ground zero because we've got all the banks.
No, we've had a sort of, should we say, pre-shocks, not aftershocks, pre-shocks of that in Cyprus possibly, which we'll be talking about after six. But let's not forget Mr. Osborne. Let's let him have the last word on this. And here is his final bit of the speech for the budget.
If you want to own your own home, if you want help with your childcare bills, if you want to start your own business or give someone a job, if you want to save for your retirement and leave your home to your children, if you want to work hard and get on, we are on your side. This is a budget. This is a budget that doesn't duck our nation's problems. It confronts them head on. It's a budget for an aspiration nation. It's a budget that wants to be prosperous, solvent and free. Thank you. I commend it to the House.
That's George Osborne there, the final bit of his budget speech. Now, Steve, I said, you know, that we'll let him have the last word, but I'll actually let you have the last word on this. I think for millions of people out there, they're not convinced that any of this is working. When are we going to see Plan B?
I think we've started to see a bit of it already. I think some of the investment, as I've said, in the housing and the infrastructure, I think we're starting to see it. I think if that doesn't come through quickly enough...
But at the moment, the forecasts are going down, aren't they?
Sorry?
The forecasts are going
down. Yeah, they are. And I think that may be where the problem is. You see, one of the difficulties is, I think there is a difference between borrowing to, you know, just keep yourself afloat and pay the current bills and borrowing to invest. And we certainly found that on City Council last year with the investment strategy and with, you know, things like the East Bristol Pool project, which I've been very heavily involved in. And I think... There is a case, as Vince Cable said, that you know, we need to think about whether we need to increase the borrowing level in order to do some of these infrastructure projects.
Isn't it a no-brainer? Because the interest rates are rock bottom right now, aren't they?
Yeah.
Time to borrow, isn't it?
Exactly. In some ways, this is a good time to do it. And I think the difficulty is making sure that it is actually something that is going into projects. I mean, there's this horrible term that I've heard bandy about, you know, shovel-ready projects. And that, you know, if you can put money in today and know that something is actually starting tomorrow, concerned that you've not got a 3-year wait for planning permission in order to get it moving, then things can happen. And I think, you know, all over the country you can see where infrastructure is needed, and you know, I hope that that can be looked at. And some of the transport schemes, for instance, that are out there in large parts of the country, including this area, then can we bring some of them forward and actually start building?
Surely, what we need is jobs. I mean, otherwise, well, we're exactly going to be in a situation in you know, maybe months or years' time, where we are staring down the barrel of the gun, rather like the Spanish, the Italians, and the Greeks.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, if you look at major projects, you know, the impact on the economy of actually doing something like that is massive compared to just the thing itself. I mean, you know, if you look at the building of Cabot Circus, for instance, I mean, that just wasn't the construction workers on site. That was people supplying materials. That was hotels that were putting people up who were travelling from distance. You know, it's the catering trade. You know, there's this big knock-on. So, I mean, if we could get something like the Bristol Metro scheme, for instance, brought forward, then, you know, it's not just the people who are putting the railway lines down. The knock-on impact on the economy is much greater. And in terms of future investment, if the transport situation in Bristol, you know, has an end date for a partial solution, then I think that will improve that.
Well, fingers crossed, eh?
Yeah.
You don't hold your breath, though. I mean, we've had this promise for years of some kind of decent public transport fix in Bristol, something which is a little bit high-tech. I mean, even a tram, actually, they were around in the 20s and 30s, weren't they?
Yeah, this is now tram is not exactly the most high-tech thing.
No,
on
but
it,
I mean, it's the kind of thing which quite clearly is needed out there. All you need to do is sit in a traffic jam. It doesn't need, not even any roadworks around. Bristol's a very congested city.
Well, I'm hoping we are making progress on, the government has approved the funding on the bus rapid transit scheme. That's part one. The metro project and reopening rail stations and so on is part two. What I'm saying is that, you know, I think if we can bring that forward, and that's one example, I'm sure there are other similar projects elsewhere in the country.
Yeah, well, we'll wait until it actually happens, because I mean, the thing is, it's all very well talking about this, but it's not actually happening. It hasn't been. One thing there is around, though, is to take the place of jobs, is workfare. Workfare makes you free. Why did so many Labour MPs accept this Tory attack on the vulnerable? This is Owen Jones in The Independent on Wednesday. Yesterday's vote should not have been clearer. A Tory government was defeated in the courts because it broke the law on workfare. This is forcing people to work in order to get their social security. The Department of Work and Pensions, according to the Court of Appeal, had illegally sanctioned unemployed people being forced to work for free, with the taxpayer picking up the bill for a measly £71 a week. Job seekers allowance is known as workfare. Martin, I mean, instead of jobs, we're getting this.
Yes, and of course the Labour Party should have opposed it. 40 some odd Labour MPs did oppose
so
it.
So why didn't they?
Because they've capitulated to this. The people on benefits are all scroungers, welfare cheats, etc.
I mean, doesn't this undermine a sort of the trade union type Labour people who are actually, you know, they're directly, you know, the trade union people are directly employed, many of them on low wages. And this workfare scheme surely undermines that. It's more difficult for people to get even the low wages.
The point is, as you pointed out, the government broke the law. They've also broken the law. It looks like that they've had targets for sanctioning people in benefit offices. So instead of, in other words, they've got to get a set number of people off benefit week by week, and that the emails have come to light in the last 24 hours, that is what's been going on, although the government's denied it. There's now going to be an investigation, because again, they're breaking the law. Now, what happens if you break the law and you're a rioter and you steal a bottle of water? Well, you go to prison. What happens if you break the law and you're the government? Well, this is retrospective legislation that's been pushed through. The courts have decided that there was the wrong decision. They're basically just paying back the money that the people were entitled to, and that's all there is to it. But the Labour Party leadership, I think, have blinked here. And I think it's to do with they're scared of losing the marginal seats where they feel that people who read the Daily Mail won't vote Labour. People who read the Daily Mail probably won't vote Labour anyway, and that begs the question of why does everything revolve around those marginal seats? And that's because we haven't got the courage for electoral reform, which we should commit ourselves to, in my view.
Steve, I mean, Martin's just talked about the government breaking the law. The city has been breaking the law. I'm just having a look here this week at the interbank lending rate scandal, the LIBOR fraud from 2005 to 2009. Barclays and RBS, the banks that have been shown so far to be involved in that, Barclays was fined £290 million, RBS fined £390 million. But this is a £185 trillion a year market. The figures that I've got here are a £10 billion a year fraud. This was over those 4 years from 2005 to 2009. But the fine, the out of court fine that these banks have paid, is only 1 week of those 4 years' profits that they made from the LIBOR scandal. It seems like fraud isn't actually a crime anymore.
Well, it does make me wonder. I mean, in my area, we had some people arrested for fraudsters on doing things like driveway repairs a few years ago. Good operation between the police and Trading Standards. And, you know, they went to jail. And it does seem rather strange that, you know, if you're a small to medium fraudster, you can go to jail. But if you're a big fraudster, then the institution... the institution gets a fine. I think the institution should get a fine, but nevertheless, if there are individuals within those institutions
if you get arrested, or if I get arrested by the police, and we were to, before we actually go to court, to have a chat with the police and say, well, I'll tell you what, I'll bung you 30-40 quid, then I mean, that would be a bribe, wouldn't it? And these people haven't actually come to court, neither the traders themselves who've been doing this LIBOR fraud, nor the directors of any of these banks have actually been prosecuted. It's all been done basically like a bribe before they come to court.
Yeah, and I think if the fraud law is going to mean anything, then there has to be some sanction. Whether they can actually, you know, begs the question as to whether they can pin it to individuals, but I suspect they probably can.
HSBC, well, they can, yes. I mean, if you had a look at the evidence, there's actually a very good article on the Guardian website. It's got all the evidence which was presented, and individual traders and all sorts of rather sarcastic comments made by those traders. The other big one, of course, is the HSBC money laundering, Mexican drug cartel money laundering fraud. That was $7 billion in cash that was being laundered by HSBC. Why? While government minister, trade minister Lord Green was chief executive of HSBC. Now, the US authorities flagged up time and again to HSBC that it seemed that this bank was being used to launder money. Martin, the fine was $2 billion, which is something like a quarter, roughly, of the amount of money that they laundered. So, again, the signals goes out. If you're HSBC and you want to run the drug cartel's money around in your armoured protected vehicles, that all you're going to get is about a quarter of the money you've made as a fine.
Yeah, I think the problem they've got is...
And you also might be made a government minister too.
Well, what's happened is that the financial system has become rotten to the core, the sort of Enronization factor. Basically, those who've been doing the cheating, conniving, the really nasty under-the-table stuff, have outcompeted those who play fair. And that's what happens if they're allowed to get away with it. And we've now got a situation where any attempt to try and seriously get to the bottom of what's been going on in the financial sector will collapse it. But in any case, it looks as if it may collapse under its own weight in any case.
Okay, before we totally go off the financial stuff and the budget, I know this is thrilling stuff for you, Stephen.
No, it's fine. It's been all right.
Stephen Williams, Bristol West MP, made what sounded to me, I mean, you know, I'm not sure about this, but he sounded like a bit of a bid to be the next Chancellor. And he was sounding very much like George Osborne when he gave his speech as part of the budget debate.
This budget, over time, will be remembered for that promise of delivering £10,000 of tax-free pay. We have cut the taxes on people in work. We have cut the tax that is a barrier for people entering work. We have given a boost for housing. We have given help for the costs of raising a family. We are indeed building a stronger economy, a fairer society, where everyone is able to get on in life. Yeah.
Stephen Williams, Bristol West MP there, as part of the budget debate. Martin, a stronger society.
Yeah, I mean, let's pick up this £10,000 tax threshold. Now, that means, of course, that everybody gets this. I would argue that you should perhaps increase the tax threshold by all means, but why should top-rate taxpayers get it as well? In other words, there's another handout to those that have is hidden behind
that.
Can
you just explain that a bit? I mean, if you're getting £10,000, you're not taxed.
You don't tax on your first £10,000, whoever you are. Yeah. Now, that means the wealthy aren't taxed on their first £10,000 either. Now, I would argue that there's no reason to give them an extra... what we really need to do is find ways of getting money off the wealthy classes. Number one, of course, if they're fraudsters, you arrest them and confiscate all their assets. So they can't say, oh, we'll go off to the Cayman Islands if you raise taxes on us. Say, we're not raising taxes on you. You're a fraudster. You're going to prison. We'll keep you in prison for 20 years, but we're having all of your assets. And, of course, the more we do that, the less we have to raise taxes on the honest ones. But ultimately, we will have to raise taxes on the honest people at the top who've done very, very well out of this bubble. The bubble's burst. It shouldn't be people in social housing paying the consequences. It should be the people who blew the bubble. That will be the people with the money.
No, he's giving some very positive noises there, Stephen Williams. Your friend, your fellow yes. Liberal Democrat.
No, I think Stephen's making a very, very valid point about the 10,000. I mean, I disagree with Martin. I do think that is important for lower paid people. Yes, it does mean that there's a benefit for everybody, but the biggest benefit is that it takes people out of tax altogether. We saw the fiasco of Labour's 10p rate a few years ago, but equally I think Martin is right that we need to find ways of getting at people of wealth. I wasn't happy with reducing the 50% rate last year. I felt that should have stayed at least until we're out of this immediate economic trough. Equally, I think, you know, one way you can tax people, and of course there's a lot of very wealthy foreigners in this country, not in Bristol so much, but certainly in London, and one way you can hit them is with the so-called mansion tax. Mm-hmm. Because you know, property doesn't move. You can move money in. I mean, it's always struck me as being slightly odd actually with our banking system. If I go and pay a check-in, it'll take 5 days to clear. I can actually move money to the other side of Europe or the other side of the world on the telephone in seconds. But one thing that you could do is bring the mansion tax in and tax people with property. And I think that that would go a long way towards doing it. But I think Stephen's right to make the positive points about the budget. But what I would say is, you see, we're not getting much in the way of an alternative from Her Majesty's official opposition, are we? Labour are promoting this, well, rather than do the 10,000, you knock 5% off VAT. Well, that helps wealthier people as well, because they tend to spend more. I mean, when Labour did this before, I benefited quite a bit, because that was the year I bought a new car and two plasma screen TVs. So, I mean, I did my bit for the Japanese economy. But in actual fact, I don't actually think that was particularly beneficial, and it's short term, and it didn't preserve retail jobs for very long.
It's a fair point you make there, Steve, because I don't think really from Ed Miliband and Ed Balls there was really much of a reply. I mean, Ed Balls mentioned the Bullingdon Club, but then of course he's in the Bilderberg Group with George Osborne. You know, it sounds a little bit sort of cheeky of him, really. Well, where is the opposition answer? Because we weren't hearing. In fact, many of the interviews done around the budget, they were saying, "Oh, well, we can't say what we're going to do." Well, look, what would you do if you were in power? There is no vision.
Well, I think the problem is that they have basically locked themselves into a situation where they won't critique the fundamentals of the policy that they're opposing. So, in other words, they say, and the point they're making is they shouldn't have done what they've done, which is totally correct in my view. We could have lost our credit rating and still kept 2%
GDP. No vision, Martin.
Oh no, but that's looking through the back window. You know, that doesn't help us going forward at all. But I mean, fundamentally, we've got to start thinking outside the box. The Grillistas in Italy, who took 25% of the seats in the recent Italian election, are calling for a citizen's income for all.
So if you were Ed Balls, you'd be calling for a citizen's income?
No,
what else?
He won't call for citizen's income. If I was him, he's trapped by the fact that the Labour Party, until this policy...
But you're not, Martin, so what would you be calling
for? What we need to do is actually nationalise the banks and give everybody a citizen's income, tax the wealthy, go after the fraudsters at the heart of all of this, because there's a whole lot of money to be got there. Peter Galbraith, who's the son of John Kenneth Galbraith in the US, is an academic over there. He's really researching this and pushing this very hard. I mean, in the savings and loan scams in the 1980s, which were much less problematic than stuff we've been seeing recently, 1,000 top executives in the US were sent to proper prison, where they've got to watch out for Mr. Big in the showers. I mean, that was 20 years ago.
I mean, the last Labour government did partly do that when we had the Northern Rock collapse. What they did was they nationalised the debt and privatised the profit. And actually, Stephen Williams, who was on the air earlier, has called for RBS, which is which is a nationalised bank. You know, his solution is that we give everybody a share in it. And I think that that's certainly one possibility.
Okay. Can I just answer that?
Yeah, cool.
The bank is bust. A share in a bust bank is worth nothing.
Okay, and back to the real world now, from the crazy world of finance.
But they're
going to
sell it.
The government is wide open to subsidy blackmail from EDF over a new nuclear build. This is the announcement this week that EDF has got its planning permission to build two new nuclear power stations at Hinkley Point. I thought it was only one, but apparently not. There's two. The price of these reactors has risen inexorably to £14 billion apiece. This exorbitant capital cost, together with market uncertainties over dithering government energy policy, has frightened off a whole stream of potential partners making any bid themselves or collaborating with EDF, including the Chinese and the British. That is Centrica, who own British Gas. Now, Steve, it seems now we're utterly dependent on nuclear, so there is no option. Planning permission has to be granted for this nuclear power station, because if it isn't, the lights are going to go out.
I despair of this country, and I wonder why we get to the position we're in. I mean, I'm a long-standing member of Stop Hinkley. I used to live a bit nearer to it than I do now for a few years. But
why did you move away?
Actually, not to escape Hinkley, because if you look at where the radiation goes, it comes up the Bristol Channel. But long-standing ambition to get back to Bristol. But concerned about this one, because we seem to have this weird mindset in this country. If somebody wants to put a few wind turbines up, then there's you're ruining the countryside, it's all terrible, and people in blazers say it's the end of civilization as we know it.
But how many million wind turbines
nuclear power station, no problem.
But how many million wind turbines will produce the same electricity as one nuclear power station?
Well, it's not a question of that alone. It's the biggest thing that I think we've failed to do is actually reduce energy consumption, because better insulation programs and better building standards would actually mean you don't need to generate as much. But you see, Germany's managed to go non-nuclear and is leading Europe in terms of investment in green technology, and yet again we seem to have missed the technological boat, and we're falling back on old solutions. I'm not happy with this one at all,
Martin. At least this is going to create jobs, even if you do have to wear a funny suit to work each day.
Well, yes, I mean, they've had to agree that they're going to have to subsidise it. So, in other words, we're subsidising this. Great, that's fantastic. We're also subsidising British aerospace, as we heard earlier. I'm in favour of subsidising British aerospace, but I've got a secret to tell you. That's not free market policy, subsidising things.
I mean, they've actually cut the subsidies, haven't they, for solar panels, for example. But they've decided
there's nothing wrong with subsidising things. It's just the intellectual incoherence of people who don't believe in subsidies except for their pet projects.
And why is this a pet project? Because at the end of the day, Martin, if they don't build this thing, the lights are going to start going out around 2017,
I reckon. That's because, as Steve has so rightly pointed out, we've missed the boat years ago by making the wrong decisions way back down the line. I mean, the Germans recognised a long time ago that we were going to have to move towards a more green economy. I mean, the building standards on their new houses are 100% emission-free. That's it, and that's what they have to build to. Not in this country, where when we get round to building things, we jerry-build. And incidentally, this subsidy for people to buy houses in the housing market, that's turning a bit sour, isn't it? Because it actually looks as if this... I mean, I can't see that it's going to take off, because don't forget, the economy's going down the drain. Who's going to lend money on the back of that, even with subsidies? But we're... People in social housing are being told that they've got to trade down, and people who want to buy houses are going to be subsidised again. Oh, we don't believe in subsidies. We believe in the free market, except when we believe in subsidies. It's just intellectual nonsense.
Okay, we had a bedroom tax protest right across the country last Saturday, one here in Bristol, one in Bath, and another one coming up soon. And it also came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Hugh Bailey. Money the government has set aside to help people who are hit by the bedroom tax won't cover a fraction of the really hard cases, like that of my paralysed constituent who receives round-the-clock care from his wife. There's an acute housing shortage in York and they have nowhere to move to. So will the Prime Minister do one more U-turn on the bedroom tax and scrap it altogether?
First of all, let me just remind the honourable gentleman that only the Labour Party could call a welfare reform a tax. It shows how little they understand about how tax and benefit actually work. What we are doing is making available a discretionary fund, which is there for the hard cases, but recognising there's a basic issue of cost, about £23 billion spent on housing benefit every year, and there's a basic issue of fairness. Not just fairness between the private sector and the social sector, but also recognising there are 1.8 million people on housing waiting lists who would love to have a bedroom.
It's just not fair the way it is at the moment. It's, people are being subsidised to have spare rooms. We're running out of money, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, this is a difficult one, this whole question of the... I mean, it's not a bedroom tax, Cameron's right. It's a loss of benefit if you're under-occupying. I do see both sides of this. I mean, I've dealt with a number of people, as I said earlier, who are, you know, in terrible overcrowded conditions, and they just can't move on because the move-on accommodation isn't there. Now, in some cases, it's in social housing, it's occupied by people who were once a family, and then kids have grown up and moved away. And you don't want to be... I think the problem is I don't think a financial penalty like this actually solves the fundamental problem. There's two things that solve the fundamental problem. One is building more social housing so you've got more supply.
And less aircraft carriers.
And possibly less aircraft carriers. And the other side of this is can you incentivize people to downsize, but without this sort of blunt... I think this is a blunt instrument. That's the problem, and I'm not sure it's going to work.
Well, one positive thing is Bristol Mayor George Ferguson has promised not to evict any victims of the so-called bedroom tax. He told councillors last night that council tenants, this is just earlier this week, who fall into arrears because of a cut in benefit will not be kicked out of their homes. Martin, about 3,700 households in the city are expected to be hit by the bedroom tax when it's introduced on April the 1st.
Well, I welcome George's commitment to that, but of course that obviously undermines the finances of the council to some extent if these people fall into arrears, as they obviously will,
also,
because they're on the breadline. They're not going to be able to pay.
He's probably been advised by the city solicitor that he can't evict people because if an eviction goes to court and the person explains, well, I'm paying as much as I can, it's actually very difficult to evict them, Steve.
I think that's right, and I think this is a difficulty that local authorities and indeed other social landlords will get into in this position. And as I say, it's there is a problem, and I think there is a need to give people incentives to move to accommodation that fits their current need, because that's one way of freeing up accommodation for people who are overcrowded. But it needs to be done sensitively and not by this sort of blunt instrument. I mean, on the eviction, then that's been supported by Liberal Democrats on the council as well. But there is a mayor's review group into this, and I think that the no eviction policy is only until that review group reports. So we'll have to see how this plays out in the long term.
I think it's worth just letting people know, if they're worried about this, that at least the precedents in the past are, if you're in front of a judge and the council are trying to evict you or whoever it is, if you're showing that you're doing everything you can within your means to provide the rent, and the thing is, even in cases of debt, you're only expected to pay a proportion of your weekly income to sort that debt out. So in a way, it's a bit of a no-brainer. Martin, Anglican bishops, this is last week, not this week, benefits cuts, and this is a related topic, will have a deeply disproportionate effect. 43 Anglican bishops wrote to the Sunday Telegraph arguing benefit cuts will have a deeply disproportionate effect on children. This is the benefits bill, meaning that the next 3 years most financial support for families will increase by no more than 1%, regardless of how much prices rise. The one person I know on here, the Bishop of Bristol, Bishop of Bath and Wales are on here, the one person who's not on here is the new Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, the ex oil shark and city banker. Martin.
Well, I'm surprised he's not there. I'm sure Rowan Williams would have been signing this. I think also the point I would make, it's not just a question of fairness. Cutting benefits in a situation like this, where the economy possibly is flatlining and possibly going to collapse, is stupid. It's the wrong thing to do. In Iceland, they locked up the bankers and they increased unemployment benefits. In Italy, the radicals are demanding unconditional benefits for people. Not that you have to find work, we will unconditionally look after you. Just think how much confidence you could give at the bottom end of our society if you say, whatever happens, we will look after you, do not worry. And the problems we've got with housing, well, that's the solution, isn't it? Why don't we build some social housing? Why don't we really go for it? Borrow some money and really go for it.
I mean, what the government's trying to do...
Raise money through a mansion tax.
Surely, Martin, what the government's trying to do is to force people who are on benefits into work.
They can't force people into work. Employers don't want people forced to work.
Well, they can with workfare.
Well, they can, but that's like living in Soviet Russia, isn't it? What you really want is people to actually be given incentives to work. And the beauty of having a citizen's income is you don't get the money taken off you if you find work, part-time work or anything else. And the point is you're also protected... whatever your circumstances, from being destitute. Now, that, in fact, is being put forward as serious politics in Italy. It'll be serious politics in this country before we're all through.
Steve, all these bishops signing up to say basically your coalition government is hitting kids.
Yeah, well, I mean, the benefits aren't being cut. They're just not being increased by the rate of inflation. The increase is being held to 1%.
So why should children be taking the rap for bankers?
Well, the problem you've got is a link with earnings rather than a link with inflation. This is a difficult area, and one of the problems we've had structurally in the UK economy for decades is this whole problem of the poverty trap with that people don't go into low paid work because it's not worth their while because of loss of benefits. Now Steve Webb, the MP for Thornbury, ain't not far from here, I know, is working very hard on universal credit to try and get away from that system, so that not a million miles away from the sort of thing Martin was talking about, so that if you're on benefit and you go into work, even though it might be part-time 2 days a week, you can actually get some improvement in your income for doing it. I mean, I remember 20 years ago being in a position where I was offered 3 days work and had to turn it down because actually the loss of benefit made you worse off. We have to tackle this overall problem, and we fail to do so. I think other countries have.
I'm signing on because I've got a part-time job, and I find that there isn't actually a reduction in benefit if I do bits of extra work. They just recalculate it. I get a bit less benefit, but not less overall. Press regulators, our final story, press regulation deal sparks fears of high libel fines for bloggers. This is in The Guardian on Tuesday. This is the Leveson deal, which has been done for a royal charter, supposedly. Bloggers could face high fines for libel under the new Leveson deal, with exemplary damages imposed. They don't sign up to the new regulator, it was claimed on Tuesday. Now, this is a bit cheeky, isn't it, Steve? This all started with phone hacking, and now bloggers are being hit. That wasn't bloggers, that was the news of the world.
Yeah, that's right.
I snuck this little clause in, clause 29, about bloggers and online journalism.
There is a problem in that the whole Leveson inquiry, I think, didn't really reflect the world as it is. And I think one of the difficulties is, how do you deal with a blogger who takes on the role that the News of the World formerly had? I think it's problematic. It does seem to have been rushed a little. But nevertheless, I think that, the difficulty is if we've now got the Leveson legislation or some version of it, does that mean that type of activity just goes on the web?
Martin, final word, very quickly.
People should have been sent to prison rather than messing around with press regulation. They broke the law, they should have gone to prison. All the top level people in News International should be behind bars.
Okay, thanks very much. You have heard today Steve Comer, who's the Lib Dem councillor for Eastville, up for election in May. After the news, Ian Fraser.
Online and on your mobile at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky
News Centre at 6, the country has been...